All right. You can't get better than that, all right? On a Friday morning, you can't get better than that because that just, I don't know, it was like sticking my finger in a light socket. It was just really, really great. And I have to thank my board op for that because she turned it up really loud. Kiana, thank you. There you go. We got to keep that up through the whole thing now because you're going to be surprised. All right, we have a really, really great show for you today. I'm really looking forward to this. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Marjorie Cohn, a professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. And we're going to be talking about this week's Supreme Court decision that allowed parts of Trump's Muslim ban to go into effect. So stick around for that one. It's going to be a very interesting and revealing conversation. Before that, I'm really, really pleased to welcome back to the show one of my favorite guests, although I guess everybody on this one is one of my, or my favorite guests. And that is Josh Willis. And Josh is an oceanographer and the principal investigator for Oceans Melting Greenland, or OMG. And he's got a couple of other little letter combinations that are very interesting. We're going to be talking about what the hell is going on with Greenland and the world right now in terms of, you know, the changing environment. It's just a huge, it's a crime, okay, what's going on with that. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show a person who's a regular guest and needs to be on more, I think. And we're going to be talking, it's Sansara Taylor, and we're going to be talking with Sansara about RefuseFascism.org has issued a call for a summer of struggle with nationwide actions on July 15th, being a crucial focal point in a battle to actually drive out the Trump-Pence regime. And boy, if you're at all sentient, if you have eyes open, anything, if you just happen to walk in a door where people are talking intelligently, you understand that there is something very, very serious happening right now. And there is a continuing need to get up there and to drive this regime out. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. It's very good to be with you.
Yeah. And I need to tell people that you are one of the initiators of RefuseFascism.org and very involved in actually carrying this out. And, you know, we're now 6 months into the Trump-Pence regime. I was thinking about this morning. And it's generally, it's pushing ahead with its fascist agenda, not without obstacles and opposition and stuff, but generally it's pushing ahead on all fronts. And I was thinking about this morning, while many people are still kind of feeling the urgent need to fight this regime, there's also a lot of different views on what's needed now and how to do it. And some people argue for elections, impeachment, so on, but Refuse Fascism has argued that humanity is facing a critical juncture and a very different agenda is needed. Let's jump into that. I know it's a big subject, but just carve in where you can and we'll go from there.
I'm really glad you're going to have somebody on later in the show to talk about the Muslim ban that went into effect, which is stopping, you know, Muslims, immigrants, refugees from being able to enter America, destroying lives already. I'm glad you're having somebody talking on about the destruction of the planet and the environment and how, I mean, Trump and Pence are pouring gasoline on what was already a huge emergency facing humanity of the environmental destruction, destruction of ecosystems and habitats and polluting of the air and the oceans and all of this. This is some of what's happening. But what I wanted to emphasize, and I think a lot of people are watching this, and there's many fronts. I mean, Trump, I mean, it's unbelievable the things he's tweeting, the misogyny and hatred of women and the policies to back them up and the vitriol towards immigrants and the racism and white supremacy. And all this we have to look at, we have to confront. We can't allow it to be normalized and for ourselves to become acclimated to it. But most of all, the thing I want to talk about and emphasize, and we can go anywhere, but I want to keep coming back to this, is that if you're disgusted by this, if you hate what is being done, if it turns your stomach, there is something that you need to do about it. There is no stopping fascism. This is fascism being consolidated. Stopping fascism is not a spectator sport. And Refuse Fascism is a movement that has come together in the wake of Trump's election that recognizes this danger for what it is and is uniting people from all different perspectives to stand up and recognize it's on us. We have to take responsibility for stopping this. And July 15th is a day for people to act all over the country. The demand is very simple. The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. If you believe, if you know, if you recognize the reality that immigrants are full human beings, not illegals or criminals to be demonized, terrorized, hunted down, locked up, and thrown out. You need to be in the streets if you recognize that Muslims and refugees are full human beings, that women and LGBTQ few people are full human beings, that Black and Latino people are full human beings, not people to be gunned down and incarcerated by police at extraordinary levels and then not indicted or acquitted if they go on trial. The people from all over the world are full human beings, as much as people born here, that the elderly and children and the poor of this country are full human beings and should not be deprived of health care and forced to starve or forced out of their homes or forced to die of disease because they can't afford it. If this is something that you recognize, it's a very basic thing, then you have to take it upon yourself and bring everybody you know right now, before this is normalized, before it's consolidated, and come out into the streets July 15th to say Trump and Pence must go. We refuse to accept a fascist America. That's a very simple thing, and the aim and the idea is that through doing that, we're building up the strength, we're building up, we're carving out a path, and we're calling for the millions in this country who are sickened by this to build a major leap in driving this regime from power, looking towards and hastening the time when millions can be won to stay in the streets night after night, day after day, refusing to leave and until this regime is driven from power. And we're not waiting for somebody else to do it. There's too much at stake, and frankly, no fundamental change in the interests of the people has ever come without people standing up and waging struggle, resistance from below.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get into some of that in just a minute, but I wanted to ask you something else as well, and it's really important. And this kind of falls off of what you were just saying. Refuse Fascism has argued that it's really important for people to understand that that's what we're up against, an actual fascist regime and not something less than that. Why do people need to understand that?
Well, I think it's very important because, look, there's been problems in this country. I mean, you had me on. We've talked about it. I know your show talks about it. We were not fans of Obama. He was the deporter-in-chief. There was crimes before Trump. I would say America was never great. I don't speak for everybody in Refuse Fascism when I say that. But what fascism is, it's a leap. It's a qualitative change in the form of government such that dissent and protest is criminalized, such that voices in the media who counter and expose the lies of Trump and his cabal are attacked. They're called the enemy of the people. They're threatened. They're cut out from having access to the president at all. The White House briefings aren't on camera anymore. Sometimes they're not even recorded. Trump hasn't been live before the news except for friendly Fox interviews in months. It attacks the media. It frankly remakes the courts. It remakes the courts. Trump is remaking the courts. He's packing the courts with fascists. In this recent Supreme Court greenlighting the bulk of the Muslim travel ban, it was very heavy that Neil Gorsuch, Trump's appointee, and two other judges actually were upset. They thought the entire Muslim ban should be reinstated. They didn't like just a partial reinstatement. They wanted the entire thing reinstated. So they're remaking the courts in a fascist way. And they're attacking the courts, saying, if the courts rule against me, I'll call them so-called judges. I'll threaten them. I'll disregard them. And when that change is consolidated, we're in the pathway. It's moving very quickly towards that. But when that's consolidated, it closes down the space for people to stand up and oppose it. And it's combined with, and we should be sober about this, it's combined with the kind of ethnic cleansing, make America white again, unleashing the most violent and brutal treatment of immigrants by ICE, of Black and Latino people by police. It's unleashing that, and it's unleashing a social base, a fascist social base that's carrying out hate crimes and terror on the ground that killed a man, a young Black student, Richard Collins, that killed two heroes in Portland who stood up to defend teenage Muslim women on the train. This is the kind of unleashing of a fascist Nazi social movement, and it's from the state and it's from below. And frankly, you have to stop that before it's consolidated. Right now, there's millions who hate this. There are millions who are scared. There are millions who are disgusted by everything that this concentrates. If we act, if we take it upon ourselves, we can change, we can drive this regime out. It's actually possible. But if we sit back and wait, and we hope, against all evidence, that maybe it won't be as bad as it's clearly becoming, then, you know, we've seen that in history. We've seen horrors. We've seen horrors when people sit back and wait. And so, you know, it's important that we recognize this is fascism, and that means it has to be driven from power. And, you know, if you're listening and you're not sure it's fascism, you think maybe it's neo-fascism, you think maybe that's a strong word, listen, come and stand up and be part of driving this out, and we'll debate it out as we go. But to sit back in the face of what's being done, or to think we could wait till 2018 or 2020, it's a dangerous illusion and too much is at stake. You know, and we use this slogan in the name of humanity very, very consciously, because fascism in America will not just affect the 330 million people living here. It will affect the whole planet, people around the world, and they are counting on us. And so this is, July 15th is a vehicle. It's a vehicle to stand up and say, no, we refuse to accept this. We are going to stand with those who are being demonized, who are being scapegoated, who are being terrorized. Those who are the most under the gun need to come out and show their faces and stand with courage and stand with others, and others need to have their backs. And it would be very difficult. It would be very difficult to overstate the stakes for people all over the world and for future generations. And what we do right now matters. And this is what Refuse Fascism is calling on. Wherever you're coming from, religious, atheist, if you're Christian, if you're Buddhist, if you're Muslim, if you're Jewish, we're standing together. If you were for Bernie, if you were for Hillary, if you were like me and didn't support any of them and want a full, total revolution, you know, we have to put our shoulders together in the fight against this right now. Mm-hmm. And as we do that, you know, we can debate out where to go next. But if we don't drive this regime out, and it's allowed to consolidate, it closes down the space for any positive vision for the future. And so we do have to come together and say no and act on that.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. And Sansara is a writer for RevCom.us and Revolution Newspaper and a co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. And we're talking about the upcoming July 15th actions and building up to it and building beyond that. Now, Sansara, I just have one quick question, and it's actually two, but it's linked to what you were saying in terms of people grasping the seriousness of this and also what the solution is going to be, because there's also out there, a lot of times people will say, look, they're banking on the Trump-Pence regime to sort of self-destruct because you have bozos in there, you have people who are just like flailing around, a guy who sends, you know, tweets out, you know, at all hours of the night, and they're just, you know, they can't possibly last. You have that kind of thing of the regime's going to self-destruct. You also have people pinning their hopes on a sudden upsurge of opposition to the Nazis from the Democratic Party, of all things. So let's talk about those two things together in terms of what you would speak to people who are saying that.
Well, I think that Trump and Pence, they're not a passing phenomenon. They're not a quirk. There's been deep strains, and this is something, frankly, that Bob Avakian, in a piece called The Truth About the Right-Wing Conspiracy and Why Clinton and the Democrats Are No Answer, he wrote this piece back during the impeachment of Bill Clinton in the 90s. And he was analyzing decades ago, and it's a very prescient analysis at RevCom.us, about the deep roots of fascism in this country and what was driving and building this, the strain of Christian fascism, the strain of white supremacy, the strain of growing forces both among the ruling classes of this country and a whole social base towards fascism that's been building for decades. And it's a bigger discussion than we could probably have on the air, but I just want to say, Trump didn't just sail in. He came together, and yes, he's a little newer to overt politics, but he became the face and the head of a movement that is very deeply entrenched and that is driven and responding to big challenges that America, the empire, is going through internationally and in this country. Big economic changes, big demographic changes, and this is a very extreme solution they feel they need to impose. And so whatever Trump is tweeting today or tomorrow or yesterday, you know, however strategically or unstrategically he thought that through, there's something deeper behind them, and Pence is part of that. Mike Pence is a major force within the Christian fascist movement in this country, which is very powerful and entrenched in the courts and the military and the state houses, and has a very deadly agenda towards women, towards LGBTQ people, towards repression against Black and Latino people. And so this is not a temporary phenomenon. And then as far as Trump's tweets and his crude statements, he actually is channeling a revenge, a sense of frustrated entitlement of sections of this country, white men in particular, but not only, who feel that their country is being taken away from them. And it's because there's immigrants, because there's women who are demanding equality and in the workplace. And he's channeling a revenge, which is very dangerous. And so even these things that people keep saying, oh, you know, well, he's going to get himself in trouble tweeting those things about women and blood. No, he's whipping up a revenge-filled fascist social base, and we better not dismiss the danger of that, both the danger of the deep entrenched forces and program that has propelled him to power and that is determined to consolidate fascism, and even the ways in which his know-nothingism, his narcissism, his crude misogyny, his open bigotry and racism is part of fueling and stoking and unleashing fascism in America.
All right, we have time for one big question at the end, and I think it's something we really got to dig into, which is basically what has been put out around this whole series, this thing of July 15th, going into it and beyond that, that humanity is actually at a critical juncture, and that it's not just a question of sitting back and figuring this out, but it's actually a time to act, and it's really imperative that people do act. So I wanted to talk about the plan for July 15th and beyond, what's needed on the 15th and what's needed beyond, and it seems like I can't put too much emphasis on the importance of this thing actually going through and accomplishing what it sets out to accomplish, because things don't just stay the same. You know, the fascists are moving ahead. Whatever blundering they make or anything else, it's not like, you know, they're just going to keep walking into a wall. They're actually on a trajectory towards where they plan to go and what they plan to do in the world. And basically, this action that's called on July 15th and beyond, because it's not just July 15th, but it's also beyond that too, is absolutely crucial for the well-being of humanity.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times these days you hear people say, okay, the protest is great, but what do you do the day after the protest? And what happens then? And the implication is, where's your policy decision? Who are you going to support in the election? Well, that I think is frankly, a crappy argument. Okay, first of all, the protests have mattered. But I want to say, when we call people forward, this gets to your question. It's not like, oh, the protest was nice, it made you feel good, but what's your real plan? The protests actually have mattered in disrupting the normalization. When people went to the airports after the first Muslim ban, it had an impact on the courts staying those, and it had an impact on even the Democrats getting out and demanding it. You know, when people move, it makes a difference. It changes the whole political calculus of every other force in society. So it matters in its own right. But July 15th, it's a time to pull together all the threads. We marched for women. We marched for science. We marched for the climate. We marched for immigrants. We've marched for Black lives. We've marched for pride. And all of these have been incredibly important. But now we have to pull together and demand the entire regime go for all of these reasons and more. And bring your demands. Bring your particular concerns. But all of these come together in demanding the Trump-Pence regime must go. And we're doing this on July 15th because it does matter to put that into society to say it's an illegitimate regime and the people will not stand for it. But then the day after, what the aim of this is to create a pathway, to create a pull in society of people relying on ourselves and calling out, not looking up for a savior in the Democratic Party or anybody in power to come to their senses, but looking out and calling out to the millions in society to say, the day after July 15th, you need to join us. You need to be part of getting organized. And we have to get to the point. July 15th is a leap in getting to the point where millions come into the streets and stay in the streets demanding the regime go, and create such a political crisis throughout society and frankly in the world through our demand and refusal to back down, through our determination, that they are forced from power. That's the power that we have, and that's the responsibility we have. And no one should ever underestimate the ability of the masses of people to impact and change the course of history when we dare to step outside of the official terms of debate, the official so-called approved channels, and demand what's not allowed in those channels, what's not being allowed, what's not being admitted and confronted, which is that this is a fascist regime that could be a complete catastrophe for the future of humanity, worse than what Hitler was capable of because they control a nuclear arsenal. They're a sole superpower, and it is on us. And July 15th is a vehicle to act, to say no, to say we don't want to live that way, we won't accept that future. We recognize the humanity of Muslims, of immigrants, of women, of Black people, of the people born in Yemen, and we value the truth, and we value facts, and we value science, and we don't want the planet to burn up. And we recognize that if we don't act, that's the trajectory we're on. But if we do, we can change that. And everybody listening, whether you've been at a protest or not, this is the time to come together and act. Go to refusefascism.org. We have a beautiful statement, a powerful statement. Add your name to it. sign the statement, send it to your friends, give a donation if you can, and get organized to come stand up in the name of humanity on July 15th. Bring everybody. Bring from any movement, from any congregation, from any community, come stand together. This is what the world needs from us. And there's a horror if we don't, and there's tremendous things we can accomplish if we do.
All right, Sansara Taylor, thank you very much for joining us today, and I look forward to having you back to continue this, you and other people as well. Be very, very good.
Thanks,
right?
Michael.
Sure, very important. All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor. And Sansara is a writer for RevCom.us and Revolution Newspaper and a co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. And we've been talking about the plans for a nationwide protest on July 15th and beyond. And go to the RefuseFascism.org, and you'll find, as Sansara was saying, your mind's going to be blown, and you'll find a way to plug into all this. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Josh Willis. All right, so stay tuned.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war.
All right, welcome back. That was Sunny Meadows with Just Like Germany Before the War. And yeah, I play it often, but not often enough, apparently, because it is just like Germany before the war. And sitting across from me, and you know, it's really interesting because these people who are really, really important scientists in the world really can't figure out how to run the microphone, how to make it stay still. You knew I was going to jump on that. Come on.
It's a challenge, Michael, yeah, every time.
Right. Yeah, it took me a long time to figure out which end to speak into. Okay. Anyway, and that voice is Josh Willis. And Josh is an oceanographer and climatologist. He's a principal investigator for Oceans Melting Greenland, OMG, and a project of NASA JPL. And we're talking about the dramatic news about the melting of Greenland and its contribution to sea level rise. Josh, real quick, what the hell is going on and how screwed are we?
Well, thanks for having me, Michael. You know, global warming is no walk in the park. It's serious. We're feeling the effects already. There's already impacts from sea level rise. There's already impacts from high heat. Heat waves are warmer than they would be otherwise. There's already a bunch of CO2 in the oceans eating away at the shellfish and other critters because the acidity is changing. So we're already feeling impacts. The question is, how bad do we want to let it get? Do we want to get hit in the head with a ping pong ball or a fast pitch? And that's the question we have to answer together.
Mm-hmm. But see, this is something that because we're sitting here and, you know, there's for so long, people have just, look, folks like you have been out there and you've been busting your back just, you know, digging into this stuff, you know. And for so long, vast quantities, vast numbers of people have no idea what's really happening. And when they do actually get turned on to this, there's things like, you know, well, the sea level, come on, you know, it's going to 3 feet, 6 feet, it's going to, you know. What the hell? We're just going to, you know, it'll come and go. It'll straighten itself out. Let's talk about just what's the situation with the rising sea level? Because this is something that actually, it's not going to flood the beach at Santa Monica and say, okay, that's it. It's actually something that's going to be responsible for the death and destruction of hundreds of millions of people around the world. And that's just the beginning.
Yeah. Well, the thing about sea level is it creeps up on you. We watch the sea levels rise slowly over time. And what happens is that's pretty much irreversible. We're not going to see sea level rise drop in our lifetime globally, or the lifetime of our children and probably our children's children. So when you move the baseline sea level up, what happens is the storm surge or the high tide that didn't used to matter to you, all of a sudden you're in the danger zone. And, you know, the danger zone creeps up as the sea levels rise, but you don't get hit by it until there's an event like a storm or a high tide. So it's really kind of this creeping threat that's coming along. We're beginning to see the impacts along the California coastline here. You know, for example, in San Francisco, what used to be the 100-year flood happens every 10 years now. And if you're a city planner, if you have property, if you live anywhere near the water, you know that high tides and storm surges are always a threat, and they're a way bigger threat now than they used to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, oh God, really? This is, but this thing about even when you're talking about what's happening, it seems, I think I've read this in preparing for this, I think I read where it's actually the sea level rise is even more than you guys ever expected it to be right now. And what accounts for that?
It's sea level rise is accelerating. So what we've seen over the last century, the last 50 years, is a lot of thermal expansion. So when we add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, it traps heat on the Earth, and almost all of that heat goes in the oceans, over 95% of it. When the oceans warm up, they expand. And so we've seen sea level rise from the warming of the oceans for most of the last 100 years. Also, small mountain glaciers all around the world have been melting and adding to the amount of water. But in the last couple decades, what's happened is the two huge ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica have begun to melt. They've begun to lose ice, and we can actually show that they're losing ice faster now than they were even 10 or 20 years ago. So they're accelerating. And what that means is that the upper limit for future sea level rise is higher than we probably thought before.
So let me get this straight now. Greenland is actually a huge part of the problem. Not Greenland itself, but, but what's happening there.
The people of Greenland are great. We love them.
So as far as we know, they could be out there with matches. And,
Greenland is an island covered in miles thick sheet of ice. And it's so thick that it's actually pushed the ground down to where it's below sea level in many places. And that's a problem, because what it means is that the ocean is capable of leaking more or less underneath the ice sheet and breaking up a huge chunk of it. That means sea level rise could happen much more suddenly, and we're more threatened from ice loss there now than we knew about, even a decade ago.
I'm going to revisit this right now because, damn it, I need an answer. No, but seriously, the point about when you were just talking about what makes Greenland so central to all this, I mean, I read somewhere where Greenland contains enough frozen water to lift oceans about 7 meters or 23 feet. And if you're telling me now that Greenland is actually like, number one, is it melting a lot quicker and in different ways than you guys maybe have suspected or expected? And really, what are the consequences? How is this 7 feet of, or 7 meters or 23 feet of flooding? Yeah. Is that really something we should be really concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, definitely it's melting faster than we thought. A decade ago, we thought that Greenland would take 1,000 years to melt, or hundreds of years to melt. We knew about the 20 feet, but you stretch that out over 1,000 years or a couple thousand years, and it's less scary. But every time we make a discovery about Greenland and its ice loss, we move that timeline closer to us now. And 20 feet in several hundred years, even, is a really big deal. You know, a foot or two of sea level rise from Greenland alone is enough to wreak havoc on hundreds of millions of people around the world. And that's what we're facing. That's what the concern is. And we've definitely gotten more alarmed as we've discovered more about Greenland.
We're going to continue on with this in just a second, but I want to remind people that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with oceanographer and climatologist Josh Willis. Josh is always welcome on this show, all right? He comes in and he tells us and he scares the hell out of us, and then he leaves us with, I'd like to say he leaves us with a happy face, but no, he doesn't. No. He does the exact opposite. He basically hammers to us that humanity actually has some responsibility for dealing with this. And Josh is the principal investigator for Oceans Melting Greenland, OMG, a project of NASA JPL. And we're talking about right now the dramatic news about the melting of Greenland and its contribution to sea level rise all over the world. You know, it's one of the things, Josh, I was thinking about is that, you know, when you're talking about all this, there's actually some things that have happened that people, even you guys, didn't expect. And I was reading this one thing about, one is Greenland's melting a lot quicker. It's sort of like, you know, butter in an oven kind of thing, right? But it's sort of, there was something big that happened recently about the significance of an enormous solitary ice wave. And I didn't understand that. I still don't. I want you to explain it to me. I've read the articles on it that there was this enormous ice wave. And what is that, and why is it so important to understand what that is?
Right. Well, the ice as it, one of the things you have to remember about Greenland is that the ice is moving. We think of ice in our freezer, it's just sitting there, right? But there's so much ice there that it's formed this giant sheet, miles thick, that sits on top of Greenland. And at the edges of the sheet, the ice is actually flowing like a river right into the oceans. And so you have all around the edges of Greenland these tendrils of ice that have carved deep canyons into the rock and the ground, just flowing kind of like gangbusters. Now, when I say flowing, if you were standing there staring at your watch, you wouldn't be able to see it. But a time lapse of even a single day, many of these glaciers move many feet in a single day. And so they're really carrying huge chunks of ice right into the oceans. And what I think that study was saying is that the effects that happen right at the edge of the glacier, right where the glacier breaks off and it meets the ocean, if that speeds up, then the impact can be felt way far inland. So the whole glacier is kind of conspiring, the whole ice sheet is kind of conspiring to push this glacier out into the ocean. And if it speeds up or if it makes a jump, then the impact of that can be felt way inland from the ice sheet. And why that's important is because we're beginning to learn that the oceans are eating away at the edges of these glaciers. And as they do, the impact from the ocean is propagating way into the ice sheet. And that's a sign that the oceans could really play an even bigger role than we thought in eating away at the ice. And the reason that's an issue is because oceans can eat away ice very, very quickly.
And then what happens? I mean, seriously.
Sea level rises. You know, every time we lose, I think it's like a trillion tons of ice from Greenland, which has happened about three times in the last 15 years or so, sea level goes up globally by a millimeter or so. Is that right? It's a few millimeters, I think. But you begin to add that up, and pretty soon, in a few years, it's a few centimeters. And the scary thing, though, is that the rate of all this stuff is increasing. And we really don't know how much it can really increase. How fast can Greenland really lose the ice? But I think we're going to find out.
Oh, good. Oh, okay. Well, nice. Thanks. Nice talking with you, Josh. Anyway, well, listen, I mean, that's exactly the point, though. That's where I was going. It's like when you mentioned this time about it's been happening over a period of time, something I read, and I can't remember where, but it said that watching the ice sheet in Greenland disappear, the last time this happened was tens of thousands of years ago.
Right.
That's...
Right. Yeah. I mean, we've been cycling. It's funny. A lot of folks who deny that climate change is happening point to the cycle of the ice ages and say, look, you know, climate changes naturally. And that's true. It does. The last several hundred thousand years have seen warm periods and cold periods. And about 20,000 years ago, we were at the height of a really cold period. There wasn't just a huge ice sheet on top of Greenland. There was another one on top of North America and in Siberia and Northern Europe. There were ice sheets. So there was a whole lot more ice in the world. It was a whole lot colder. And sea levels were about 120 meters, so 300 or 400 feet lower than they are today. That's when you had the land bridge across the Bering Strait and so forth. So, you know, we've lived in a climate that's changed. Now, 10,000 years ago, we warmed up out of that climate, and we warmed up suddenly. It took 100,000 years to get that cold, and it only took 10,000 years to warm up to a little cooler than today's temperature, which is where we were for most of the past 10,000 years. So we've had about 10,000 years of a stable climate, and it's not till the last 100 when we've been pumping stuff into the atmosphere that it's begun to warm really quickly. So yes, it's true, Greenland has melted really fast in the past 10,000 years ago, but it was a different climate. You know, it started off much colder, the ice sheet was much bigger, and we were warming up out of a period of extreme cold. Now, it's already warm, and we're making it warmer. So the situation is very different than it was before. And while it's good to look back at what the ice did when it was colder 10,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, there's no guarantee it's going to tell us what's going to happen tomorrow or in the next 10 years or in the next 100.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to ask you is that the things that I read said that actually the danger of sea level rise will continue for some time, for quite some time, it says, even after global warming has stopped.
Yeah.
Which I think that's sort of something people, that's a hard thing for you to get your head around. Wait a minute, we stop global warming, everything should eventually come real quick back to normal.
Yeah. And quite some time is 1,000 years, Michael. It's 1,000 years or two. The reason is when we've heated up the atmosphere and set this new warmer climate, once we stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere, the temperature will stabilize. It will level off. But it's not going to go back down. It'll be a warmer climate. And that warmer climate is heating the oceans from the surface. And it takes 1,000 or 2,000 years for it to spread all the way down to the seafloor because the ocean's very slow. That process continues. And that extra warming is what causes that very slow, long-term sea level rise. So, yeah. You know, the 1,000 years of sea level rise after global warming is done may happen more slowly, but it's definitely going to continue.
So the big question is, and you're deeply involved in this, you've dedicated your life to actually understanding this, but also I imagine trying to figure out a way to do something in relation to that. So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
What is it that can be done?
Well, in short, we have to find our way off of burning fossil fuels as much as we can. Every time we burn a ton of gasoline, it winds up as CO2 in the atmosphere, and it's there for 1,000 years. All the time that we're burning fossil fuels, whether it's coal or oil or even natural gas, we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and that's what's changing the climate. So very simply, we have to reshape our economy. No problem, right, Michael? It's easy. Reshape the economy and move towards a fuel source that is renewable, that doesn't add CO2 to the atmosphere. And, you know, just to sound a little bit of a word of encouragement, I went to a climate event earlier in the week. Eric Garcetti, mayor of LA, talked about all the things that Los Angeles is doing to reduce its carbon footprint. And there's a whole lot. Solar panels all over the place, electric vehicles, very efficient LED lighting, and so forth. And really, it's already happening. You know, we're already beginning to bend toward a more renewable economy. We just have to let it happen now.
But here's the question. I mean, because you're talking about the, you know, look, there's certain things that happen. I mean, even if one mayor does this and does these laws and people, it's much more complicated and complex. And what needs to be done is it seems to be much more profound than people, you know, not watering their gardens or people, you know, whatever, people, you know, doing what all these various things that individuals can do. Important as they may be. But there seems to be a much bigger thing that has to be tackled here. And I know you've dedicated a lot of your life to actually that bigger picture, which is something I think we really need to understand in terms of, because it's not going to be just each one teach one kind of thing. It's got to be, there's what you've been describing, there's a necessity to really act on the largest scale possible to change this. And that's what I'm trying to figure out. It's like, okay, so what does that mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, personally, I think that change, it has to happen at the highest levels. But it may reach the highest levels last. If you look at the data for people's understanding of climate change and acceptance of human drivers as the cause, it's actually gotten higher in the last few years. Even here in the United States, I think it's something like 75 or 80% of people now accept that climate change is happening and that humans are a significant cause of it. And once you accept that, then the need to do something becomes obvious immediately. And so I'm actually encouraged to see so much local stuff that is beginning to bubble up to a city level, to the state level. The rest of the international community is getting on board. We just got one last hurdle to get over.
Well, we also have the reality of who was it that withdrew from the Paris, you know? I mean, no, this is real.
This is absolutely real. No, absolutely. You know, that's one of the things they talked about that I personally found encouraging was that Eric Garcetti and a cadre of something like 400 mayors across the country signed up to meet the Paris Accord, even if the United States as a country withdrew from it. And those cities represent something like 60 million people across the United States. So it's the local efforts are becoming a non-trivial size in terms of addressing the problem.
Yeah. On the other hand, we do have to address the problem from the the macro thing.
But I agree. We do have to get there, and soon, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of, you really are, it's not, it's hard for people to understand that actually planets come into existence and go out of existence, and the things that live.
And so do species.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was just going to say. And this has happened throughout everything we know of the history of the planet, of this planet and other places as well, as far as we know. So it's sort of, there's a big job demanding to be done, and it requires a lot of understanding and also a lot of determination to just say, no, this is not going to be allowed to continue like this now.
Yeah. No, when I sound a positive note, I'm not suggesting we don't have a lot of work
to
do.
No, Josh.
We definitely do.
No, I know. I know. And you spend a lot of your life doing that. But right now we got to wrap up. So I'm going to have you back. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Michael. Great to be here, Josh.
Yeah, really good talk with you again, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with oceanographer and climatologist Josh Willis, the principal investigator for Oceans Melting Greenland, OMG, a project of NASA JPL. And we've been talking about the dramatic news about the melting of Greenland and its contributions to sea level rise, all right? We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
We're going to die out here, man. If only society had done more to fight climate change.
You don't actually believe that climate change mumbo-jumbo, do you?
I mean, I'm no scientist, but record-high global temperatures may have exacerbated our current situation.
You're an idiot. The climate might be changing, but humans aren't causing it. It's just the natural heating and cooling of the sun.
Looks like you boys could use some help.
Yes. Please, water.
Allow me. For the past 30 years, the energy from the sun has actually decreased, but the Earth's continued to warm up.
What are you, some sort of climate scientist?
Matter of fact, I am. And your argument is one of the four straw men of the apocalypse.
Straw man, an intentionally misrepresented proposition that is set up because it is easier to defeat than an opponent's real argument.
So, while the Earth does go through natural cycles of heating and cooling, the warming over the past century has been faster than any time in the last several million years. With climate change threatening our way of life, your straw man argument could have apocalyptic consequences.
That's bull. Scientists have shown that the ice around Antarctica is expanding.
There you go again, straw man. The continent of Antarctica is actually losing ice, and it's happening faster and faster every year, driving sea levels higher around the world. The floating sea ice around Antarctica has grown very slightly due to changes in the wind, but the water and air are still warming up.
But the Earth is getting greener. The plants love the carbon. And people like it warmer too.
Truth is, the bad impacts of global warming far outweigh the good ones. Although some regions can have milder winters and longer growing seasons, the hotter summers, intensification of wildfires, ocean acidification, and global sea level rise will cost way more than any benefits we might see. Our civilization is built on the climate we've had for the last 10,000 years, and living in a hotter one is not going to be easier.
The debate isn't over. There's only 97% scientific consensus.
Really? Well, what about the other 3%?
Well, I know those other 3%, and let's just say they're more than 6 standard deviations away from the mean on a Poisson distribution.
God, you are a nerd.
What does that even mean? Get out of here, you blue giant.
Sometimes when people are presented with evidence that contradicts their worldviews, they wade even deeper into the river of denial. That's called cognitive dissonance, and it means that they'll keep denying no matter how much scientific information is dropped into their laps. Sometimes, you just have to know when to walk away from straw men and false equivalencies and leave science deniers in the dust.
Wait, we forgot to get the water.
All right, that was a little bit more of Josh Willis, and it was his piece, Straw Men of the Apocalypse, and you can find that on YouTube and on my Facebook page. Well, if you've been at all paying attention to the news over the last week or so, you know that some very big things have happened in relation to the Trump-Pence regime, and in particular in relation to what's happening with what they called the Muslim ban. And it's extremely serious, folks. People really got to look into this and understand what's happening and stand up and say something and do something about it. And joining us to talk about this is Marjorie Cohn. And Marjorie is a professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and a former president of the National Lawyers Guild. And her book on drones, which I read when it first came out, is really a great book, and it'll soon be out in an updated edition as well. So, and oh, I want to make sure that this comes out too, so people know from the very beginning. You can go to Marjorie's website, and there's a lot of information there. Marjorie Cohn, that's MarjorieCohn.com. All right. And now I'm going to welcome Marjorie to the show. Marjorie, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's been a while since we talked, and I'm really looking forward to it. So let's jump into it. What just happened with the resurrection of Trump's Muslim ban and the significance of the rise? And let's talk about that. What's just happened with the resurrection of Trump's Muslim ban and the significance of the rise of Neil Gorsuch?
Well, now Trump can exclude foreign nationals from 6 countries, Iran, Libya, Syria, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen, who do not have a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States. And so what happened is that this is a temporary compromise pending the Supreme Court's decision on the merits in October when it reconvenes. So it is a partial temporary victory for Trump. If they had 5 votes, which apparently they didn't, they could have left all of it suspended, all of the ban, until they took it up in October. But apparently they didn't. Kennedy and Roberts probably wanted this temporary suspension. The court issued what's called a per curiam decision, which means by the court. So no one took the rap for writing it. But it was unanimous. In other words, everyone other than the 3 dissenters joined into that per curiam decision, allowing part of Trump's suspension, exclusion of people from those 6 countries to go into effect temporarily. And the dissenters were Thomas dissented, and Gorsuch and Alito joined his dissent. The dissenters would have excluded everybody covered by Trump's ban. In other words, would have said to Trump, you can exclude anybody you want under this ban without limitation. Now, Gorsuch joined Alito and Thomas, the far right of the Supreme Court, and this is not a good sign for the future of putting limits on executive power, at least with Gorsuch's vote. It shouldn't really surprise us, coming from a person who obediently defended torture, warrantless surveillance, and runaway executive power under the George W. Bush administration. It shouldn't surprise us, but, you know, people always hope that when a justice gets on the court, they will be more tempered, more moderate. He is turning into a Scalia clone in many different ways. When Gorsuch worked in the Bush Justice Department, he argued against Guantanamo detainees who wanted to bring habeas corpus petitions to challenge their detention. He opposed the Detainee Treatment Act's prohibition of cruel treatment. He argued that enhanced interrogation works. That's a euphemism for torture. And he defended Bush's warrantless surveillance program. And when he was challenged on those positions that he took during his confirmation hearing to join the Supreme Court, he said, oh, that was my job. I was just following orders, basically. And in other cases as well, we've seen him way on the right and really would make Scalia proud, but very, very dangerous to civil rights and civil liberties.
Mm-hmm. Now, Trump's argued that his presidential power, and you were beginning to speak to this, but he's argued that his presidential power to control immigration and protect national security, and whatever he means by that, cannot be reviewed by any court at all. So he's basically, you know, he seems to be stepping up and saying, look, I am the one in charge and you'll say nothing to me. So it's sort of, you know, it's really a very heavy situation there with where he's arguing that presidential power is limitless in relation to this stuff.
Yes, I mean, most presidents certainly push the limits of executive power, but by him saying it's unreviewable, that means the courts have no role at all when he is making decisions about national security and immigration. And of course, that's just not true. We know that the Supreme Court checks and balances the executive. It did during the Bush administration. The Supreme Court said you can't deny Guantanamo detainees their right to habeas corpus just by locating a prison, you know, 90 miles off the coast of the United States. And so the High Court did check and balance the executive during the Bush administration. but we'll see what it does. Again, this is a compromise, and there's all kinds of litigation now. One thing that Thomas and the other dissenters correctly said is that the court's remedy, this compromise, will prove unworkable because government officials are going to have to decide whether those who seek to enter the U.S. have sufficient connections to a person or entity in the United States. This will invite a flood of litigation as parties and courts struggle to determine exactly what constitutes a bona fide relationship, who precisely has a credible claim to that relationship, and whether that claim relationship was formed simply to avoid the travel ban. And they're absolutely right, and that's precisely why the court should have put a hold on the entire travel ban pending its decision on the merits. Now, this issue of who has a close enough family relationship to be allowed in, even if they come from one of those six countries, the State Department issued a cable, and they are defining close family as including parents and parents-in-law, spouses, children, adult son or daughter, son-in-law, daughter-in-law, sibling, whether whole or half, and that includes step relationships, and they've recently added fiancé to that list. But close family does not include, and that means that people who have this relationship with a person in the U.S. cannot come in for 90 days if they come from one of those nine countries. Close family does not include grandparents, grandchildren, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, cousins, brothers-in-law, and sisters-in-law, and other extended family members. This is a very narrow interpretation. And so it says, well, you know, your father-in-law can come in, your daughter-in-law can come in, but your grandmother can't come in, your grandfather can't come in. And it's, you know, Thomas was right. It is inviting all kinds of litigation. In fact, there has already been a lawsuit filed in Washington asking the court to allow the entry of refugees with no credible claim of a bona fide relationship. Now, that would directly contradict the Supreme Court's ruling, but there is going to be tremendous litigation about what constitutes a close enough family relationship. And Trump signed an executive order, his first Muslim ban, on January 27th, and then when courts right and left were striking that down as being unconstitutional and violating the Immigration Nationality Act, then he instituted a second Muslim ban on March 6th that was slightly less objectionable, but still very objectionable. It took Iraq out of the list of prohibited countries. It lifted an indefinite ban on Syrians. It said green card holders are not affected, and it didn't have any preference for religious minorities, such as Christians claiming persecution in mostly Muslim countries, which was one of the big things that people pointed to say that the ban violated the Establishment Clause. But we still have two circuit courts, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, that struck down this second Muslim ban. The Fourth Circuit said that it violated the First Amendment's Establishment Clause because it was motivated primarily by a desire to exclude Muslims. And the appellate court ruled 10-3 that the Trump's executive order drips with religious intolerance, animus, and discrimination, and cited his campaign statements calling for a Muslim ban. Chief Judge Roger Gregory wrote for the majority, and he said, and listen to this, he said it's entirely plausible that the executive order's, quote, stated national security interest was provided in bad faith as a pretext for its religious purpose, unquote. Basically saying that the administration is lying. When Trump issued this Muslim ban on March 6th, he said that nationals of those six predominantly Muslim countries present heightened risks to the security of the United States, and some of those who have entered the U.S. through the immigration system have proved to be threats to our national security, even though there have been no nationals from those six countries that have engaged in any kind of a terror attack, at least since 1975. And then the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals didn't reach the constitutional issue, but said that the Muslim ban violates the Immigration and Nationality Act, and says that that Trump's executive order doesn't give a rationale for singling out people from those six countries and why their entry would be detrimental to the United States. And the Immigration and Nationality Act requires the president can suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens when it would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. And then the Ninth Circuit panel said that the executive order doesn't tie these nationals from these six countries in any way to terrorist organizations or identify them as contributing to active conflict or those responsible for insecure country conditions, and it doesn't provide any link between an individual's nationality and their propensity to commit terrorism or their inherent dangerousness. And then the panel, this is a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit, wrote, national security is not a talismanic incantation that once invoked can support any and all exercise of executive power. The court, the Ninth Circuit, also found that the executive order violates a provision of the Immigration and Nationality Act that prohibits discrimination in the issuance of immigrant visas on the basis of race, sex, nationality, birthplace, or place of residence. So these are the two lower court, appellate court decisions that the Supreme Court is going to rule on, and they can certainly go off on other issues. I mean, the Supreme Court in October, when it comes back and takes up this case, will certainly deal with the First Amendment issue, First Amendment Establishment Clause issue, and the Immigration and Nationality Act, but it might also take up constitutional challenges based on due process and equal protection, as judges in New York, I think two judges in New York and one in Massachusetts, found that his first Muslim ban violated due process and equal protection. So who knows which way the court will go when it actually hears the merits in October.
We're going to have to wrap this up real quick though now, because it's now we're running out of time, and it's fascinating. I want to get into it more. We'll have you back to talk about this more, Marjorie. Definitely, we'll have you back very soon, because I also wanted to get into something that you've argued, that Trump's Muslim ban deserves total destruction. And boy, I couldn't agree with you more. Okay, it is as far as I'm concerned, it is a crime against humanity. And I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Michael. Thanks so much.
And we will have you back, Marjorie. So let's pick it up later, okay?
Okay, great.
All right, great. Thank you. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Marjorie Cohn. And Marjorie is a professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. And her website is Marjorie Cohn, MarjorieCohn.com. And you can find out a lot of interesting information there. And I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my always wonderful board op. My always wonderful. You don't need to point to her, man. I know what. My always wonderful board up, Kiana Williams. We're going to go out now with We Got to Get Out of This Place from the Animals. Talk to you again next week.
In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me it ain't no use in trying. My little girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, you're gonna die before